Shambho Mahadeva Deva, Shiva Shambho, Shiva Shambho.
Bhavatu sahanau bhunaktu sahavīryam karavavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Can you please talk about being introverted? I find myself feeling tense and uncomfortable in groups of people, even though I wish to participate. I often feel overwhelmed by insecurity. How to handle this? Well, one thought that comes to me, one memory. My brother, George, he actually passed away about 15 years ago. He was gay, and when he was just kind of coming out and just really finding himself and feeling like himself, like he could breathe, you know, he was starting to go to some popular gay bars in the city, and he had some good friends, and he was very introverted, very shy and everything. And so he'd just kind of be standing around by himself. he didn't want it to be like that at all, but that's how it was. And so one of his friends gave him a little hint. He said, smile. Such a simple thing, you know. Oh, and when he started, so he did it. When he started doing that, then he was approachable, you know, because he was a very, very, very good-looking guy, very nice guy, you know, so wonderful. But I was probably just really kind of, what am I supposed to do? Oh, and then probably all these people, I don't know what to do. So all he had to do was smile, you know. So that's the first thing that came to me. And it was very, he was, and he told me, and I thought, for myself, oh, that's a good idea. Maybe I'll try that. Because I was also pretty introverted, actually, you know. So that's such a simple thing, you know. And then I had a Jungian analyst who I worked with. And there was a time when I really wanted to become a Jungian analyst, but by the time I was able to even get involved in that, I was just too old. I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't go back to school and all of that. But I spent a lot of time studying Jung and being an intern for the Jung Institute, and that when I was studying to be a psychologist. So. And during that time that I went, I had to be in my own analysis, which I really wanted to do. I wanted to see what that was like and experience that and go through all of that. But I said this fellow, my analyst at that time, his name was Larry Jaffe. And he died some maybe 10 years ago now. But he is also a real introvert. And so somehow this introversion question came up. I don't remember how it came up, but he gave me his solution to it. He said, just be interested in the other person and ask a lot of questions. Because most people like to talk about themselves and what they're doing. And if you feel like you don't have anything to say, it doesn't really matter. You just find in any given person, what are you interested about in that person? You know? It's such a simple thing. So those are the two things. Smile. And then put the focus, instead of on yourself, put it on the other people and what you're interested in about them, and then the problem is really solved. And so that's kind of a secular answer. Not a Vedantic answer exactly, mm-hmm. But it's a secular question, and you know, I think it's a good answer. I know how well it works, and it's really wonderful, actually. You just you do the smiling, and then see what you're interested in about that person, and then it's really wonderful because you're engaged. You don't want to ask something that you think that they might want you to ask. Then that heart isn't there. So you find what you're interested in, and you ask about that, ask them about that, something about themselves. So, simple. Can the agami karmas manifest both in this life and in the future life? Please talk about the origin of the Hare Rama, Hare Krishna chant. Does it come from the Vedas, and if so, where? Okay. they say that... Oh, wait a minute. Well, the agami karmas are the karmas that you're accruing in this life, right? So you're exercising your free will in this life. So the sanchitta karmas are not manifesting now, for sure. They're just waiting, you know, for an appropriate time to enter in this prarabdha, as the collection of prarabdha karmas that cause you to take a birth. So until that situation is correct, certain ones of those agami karmas will not manifest. They won't manifest until the situation is correct at that time of death when you're bringing those karmas to yourself. So they just stay dormant until the time is right for them to come into manifestation, which would be any one of the births that you take, the prarabdha karma that's involved. So the sanchitta comes from the prarabdha. The agami karmas, for the most part, let's see, how did you word that here? It's a good wording. The agami karmas, and here we're really talking about the karma palas, the results of the agami karmas. Sometimes they say that those can manifest later on in a given life, that punya and papa can manifest later in a given life. But for the most part, what is kind of the norm is that those agami karmas go into the sanchitta, and they will be manifest. That's the karma, they're called adrishta palas, and those unseen karmas, you know, will manifest at a later time with another birth. So it's not in stone, because Swamiji has said once, I remember clearly, that he said that sometimes agami karmas can manifest later in one's lifetime. Because so those are the karmas that you're accruing right now. So they can have some effect later on in the lifetime. It's possible. But normally, they're going into the sanchitta. The origin of the Hare Rama, Hare Krishna chant, I don't really know. I'd have to look into that. Also, whether it's to be found there in the Vedas or it's just found in the tradition itself, I don't know. I do know that it's considered to be a very, very sacred chant. Wouldn't be surprised if it's somewhere in the Vedas, but I don't think so, because Rama and Krishna are not in the Vedas. That comes later. So, but no, I don't know the origin. Do you?
Yeah,
what did you hear?
I forgot this right now, but I have the document.
You have what?
A document
that talks about
where it comes from.
Okay, so maybe you can get it in.
Yeah.
Do you have it on your computer?
Yeah.
Okay, so next class.
Yeah.
Next satsang. Mm-hmm. So I'll put this back.
Okay.
So we'll do it next time. That would be interesting.
Well,
I'd like
to.
Yeah. Good. That's a good idea. I'd like to know that too. That would be good. As a desire arises, I find myself imagining and daydreaming about how it would be to fulfill it, while at the same time not wanting to have the desire, as I know the pain and attachment that comes with it. What can be a healthy way of handling a desire? When the desire has come, the best way is with that prasada buddhi, which means that as long as the desire is not harmful to yourself or others, if it's within dharma, if the desire is within dharma. And when that desire has come, you actually don't know whether that's part of the prarabdha karma or something that you picked up along the way. You know, so I would just go with the desire, because you have the energy, right? Like, say, if you have a desire, I want to learn Sanskrit. Isn't that wonderful? You know? You should just go with it. Just go with it. But accepting all of the results of prasad as with that prasada buddhi, then you won't have any worries about it, because if you're not learning as quickly as you want, or you realize that your memory isn't as good as you wish it would be, and you know, You're learning at a very slow pace, slower than all the others and all the things that everybody, you know, gets in a tangle about. You don't care. It doesn't matter. You just learn for the joy of learning. It's a beautiful, sacred language that you don't need to make it into anything more than that as a great punya, even to be able to play with it and learn it what you can. And just enjoy that. Then with that prasada buddhi, you know, just put it whatever energy is that, whatever the amount of energy is the desire pushes for, then do that and take the results and your the how fast you're assimilating it and learning. Just prasad, it's fine, it doesn't matter. You know, just enjoy the fact that you're learning it. Yeah. That was convenient. From a little pep talk. And okay, so this, as the desire arises, I find myself imagining and daydreaming about how it would be to fulfill it. Well, the only thing about that, I mean, imagining and daydreaming is a beautiful quality that I think that everybody should try to develop, their imaginal abilities, you know. But sometimes what happens for us is when we think about the future, the mind is just imagining, spends a lot of time imagining how to fulfill it, what it's going to be like when I have it, what if it doesn't happen. And then with that, in that imaginal world, when it's like that, it's coming off of a desire, it just kind of takes you away with it. You can end up experiencing, because often, like you, when you can imagine the positive results, the mind being what it is, will imagine the negative possibilities too. It just knows. It does the whole gamut. It doesn't just choose one side. You know, almost always it'll have both sides. And then you will start suffering from your imagination. And so that's what, you know, we are often, that imagination, that type of imagination is called worry. It's like when you start thinking of the future, well, this could happen or that can happen, and I start living in an imaginal world that just all kind of automatically takes place. But when you're imagining something, a positive or negative outcome, you will feel the emotions. The imagination brings with it the emotions of that outcome. And so say it's a catastrophic outcome, you'll be actually experiencing these catastrophic emotions, or these depressed, hurt, frightened, all of these different kind of emotions are triggered by that imagination. And so we try to, if you're using the imagination, like say you have a desire, then one thing even people in sports do is they'll imagine that. It's almost like it's a way Swamiji prays, in fact. You imagine that positive outcome. You see it, you feel it, you know. That's something that you are doing consciously. It's like a prayer, you know. And you feel good about it and all that. You see the whole thing. And then you come back because you've done it consciously. That's positive. That's using your imagination in a very positive way. But the problem is with this kind of spontaneous imagination that's occurring all of the time is that it actually can take up a tremendous percentage of your waking life. So much time is spent in worry over the future or hurts of the past, you know? And the smaller percentage is spent just being here with Ishvara, with my life, with this is my life, this is my prarabdha karma at this time, you know, this is Bhagavan, and I'm present to it and I can be totally engaged. I'd say that's that's a minority of time. Many, many, many people don't spend much time in the present. They're either this way or that way, you know. And that we want to curb. We just keep, when you catch yourself out there, come back. You just catch yourself out there again, come back. Or you're perseverating around a painful event that happened that has affected your life in some way, and the hurt is a lot, and you can't let it go. So your mind automatically is going there and feeling the sorrow and the suffering involved with that. That we want to pull our mind back to. if we want to do inner child work, consciously going into that space, that's different. Because I'm in the present, consciously, doing this work on that event. You see what I mean? That's totally different than when your mind is just taking you there and you're living that out again and again and again without being with it in a way that is useful and healing. So that's important. So healthy way of handling the desire, if it's within Dharma, is with that prasada buddhi that allows you the energy to pursue it. That's again why Krishna is kind of telling Arjuna to stay in the world and not give up all of those things. If you take sannyasa, then really your sphere is teaching, studying, and meditation. Nothing else. That's what you do. Teach, study, and meditate, contemplate. The other things are outside of the sphere of sannyasa, really. So. And that's your Swamiji. But, you know, unless you're Swamiji or whatever you want to say. But the problem is the rest of society, Swamiji is so huge that everybody just follows along. Whatever Swamiji does, that's But if he isn't revered in that way, then whatever little, especially in India, whatever thing you do that kind of goes astray from that sannyasa dharma is looked at very disapprovingly. So I wonder what he's doing, you know. So just how it is. You don't want to be under those constraints. You don't want to. Everything that you want to do or need to do or is in you to do is just met with a big wall of disapproval, and so you really can't do it. And you have to stay in this confined, relatively confined life because you're wearing the orange, you know. And and so some of the things that you need to do, there's no opening for that, and so that's not healthy. So you should stay in with your knowledge, kind of stay in the field, stay in your prarabdha karma, stay in this karma, stay in the field until, you know, this is what I often joke and say, until this becomes your tree that you're sitting under, you know, so it's not triggering you. And then you're a sannyasi here, you're just some sannyasi there, it doesn't matter. You can take sannyasa then. Can we do seva at your farm? What times in the year? Well, that would be really nice. I think that I'll just tell you what the situation is. Until probably the end of December, I'm still working at the school. I have one more semester that I really am obligated to do. So that means, except for going to Crete, I'll be half of the week at the farm and half of the week at school, just commuting back and forth. But after that, I'll either, you know, be in one of the places that I go to, which is now mostly just over here and maybe Colorado, you know. And the rest of the time I will be at the farm. And so when I'm at the farm, you know, everybody knows the website, arshakulam.org. You can always look and see when retreats are being given there, or when you have time to come, you can see if there's, especially if it's in the winter, there has to be like a room available. If there's a room available, I'll say, yes, please come. And there's lots of work there, and there's also classes. Now, I always, if we're having a camp, the camp is like this in the terms of the schedule. If we're not having a camp, then it depends on who's there, how many people are there, how many classes we have, you know. Probably two or three, like that. But if you come, I'll give classes too. just to get you there. There's a lot of work, like one of the things I'm most worried about that I told Anna about is the pruning, because there's a lot of trees. There's a lot of fruit trees there. And we haven't been able to prune them. Either there's an early spring and they've blossomed way early, like in January last year, or the year before that, we didn't have it together. We didn't know what we were doing, really. And so now we know, and we want to get it done, but it's hard because we don't know how to do it, really. It's one or two people who've had a little bit of experience, and the poor trees are, they're poor little branches are all over the place. And a lot of them, so just imagine a beautiful, beautiful fruit tree. So we have this beautiful fruit tree, and then on the top of it, it's like, imagine, I don't know. do you know what a butch is? This butch, do you have that? You know what that word means? It's like say if they give you, for a man, they give a, your hair goes up like this and they just crop it off. Well, this is like that, except it goes up like 5 feet. All of these little, I saw like little roots or something, they're straight up. And they're, poor things, they're probably a couple thousand. And there's a lot of them. There's really a lot. Maybe it's just 1,000. There's a lot. Like on one tree, there's over 100 on one tree. Definitely. Yeah.
They've been pruned too hard.
What?
They've been pruned too much.
Yeah. At some point. Poor things. And they need a lot of love.
It's not good. Let's make a date.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. You should come over and see me. Okay. Yeah. Then you can teach us. We get a group and you can teach us.
Yeah.
Yeah. We get the right equipment and all that. So. Yeah. So I would love you all to come. I hope you can just have to start coming to the States and coming and staying there, especially when I'm staying. If I'm staying there, which is what my hope is, just be staying there, and you can come and stay, for some time. Study. Learn Sanskrit. Learn the bhashas, Have contemplations. Sit by the river, It's really a beautiful place. The winters are kind of cold and rainy, but not as cold and rainy as here. They're not dark. It gets dark at 5 and gets light at 7 for a couple of months out of the year, like December, January. And then it's 5:30 and 7 like that, and then 6. And then in the summer, it gets dark at 9 and gets light at 5. So that's how that goes. So I like it to be light, but the winters are nice too. We just light fires and sit around the fireplace and read books and talk and whatever. Like here, probably just cuddle up around the fireplace. And anyway, it's a beautiful place, and I like it when people are there, so just let me know. Mm-hmm. We'll have a lot longer camps and things like that once I don't have the obligations at the school. I think I'll just probably, every month we'll have something going on. And then other people, there's a lot of people who are just there because they're just part of Harvest and they just come to do things and stay there, and so there's not a camp or anything going on. But when there's a camp, there's probably 15 to 20 people, 22, 23 people. But it has to be during the summer because we don't have enough rooms for that many people yet. So that's part of the work that can be done. Building rooms. What is the difference between pain and suffering? Oh, between pain and suffering. Okay, that's the first one, an ego and a hankara. Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's, I'd say what I think the difference is to me pain would be like physical pain, like my leg hurts or something. And suffering seems kind of more long-term. I don't really know, I'm just telling you what I think. There's no real definition. Okay. But for me, suffering, like if I said, when I said Swamiji really suffered, what I meant was, it wasn't just a pain. You know, I have a pain in my leg, and then that pain comes and goes like that. There was ongoing pain, you know. You know, like, and so I see suffering more as ongoing pain. And even mentally, if you say this person is really suffering, you don't think like, well, they got angry and, you know, or they had an emotional outburst or something that lasted, but they're actually really suffering over something. Something is really bothering them, you know, and they're really hurting. You can say, then if you're saying that, I would say they're really suffering, or you might say they're in a lot of pain. But the idea is suffering. It has some kind of continuity. So that's kind of the difference for me. But maybe somebody would use those terms in a way where they mean, where they're it's almost synonymous. Like you say, this person was really, you know, like say when this person, when his father passed away, he really suffered a lot. Or you said he was in a lot of pain. He was a lot of pain over that. You don't think of just a hangnail or something. You think there's an ongoing pain. So I don't know. Ego and ahankara. Okay. The word ahankara has a very specific meaning, Vedantic meaning. It's a technical term in Vedanta. And what it is where it's a type of vritti that superimposes what we call that causes a mutual superimposition between the atma, between yourself and whatever we call, and an upadi. An upadi is anything, the body, mind, sense organs, or its qualities, which can receive the I, like I am this body, you know, or you can say I am of such and such an age, or I am a man or woman. So all of these are qualities of the body or then the whole body itself. So that's the ahankara, or it could be, the ahankara could be identified with a mind, or the experiences of the mind, the emotions of the mind, or identified with the intelligence or non-intelligence of the mind, or with the sense organs, in terms of I or mine. These are, you know, my eyes are not doing well. So now I'm identified that these are my eyes, they belong to the self, to myself. So the eyes become an upadi. So the ahankara has a very specific meaning, right? A defined meaning, where the word ego is a psychological term, and actually the ego is defined quite differently by the different psychologists who are like, whether it be Kohut or Freud or Jung or any or Winnicott. I'm just giving you a list of some of the very well-known psychologists in the States. Their definition of the ego is going to be fit into their whole psychological model, and there'll be some differences over that, you know. So that's a psychological term that is kind of dangerous for us to use as a translation for the ahankara. Because if you do use it as a translation for the ahankara, then you have to define exactly what you mean by ego, which every psychologist has to do. If they're writing a book on their psychological model that they're following, they have to define every single term that they use, because other psychologists are using those terms differently. Right? Whereas if we're talking about ahankara, that's a Vedantic term, this is how it's defined, and you know very clearly what it is. So. Can you talk more about the Atma? Well, we define Atma even in the Vedanta, even in the Upanishads, we define it as the self, and then sometimes when I'm talking about the self, we're talking about it within vyavahara, within empirical reality. And so in that case, the atma could be referring to the mind, or the atma could be referring to the body. Like in English, if I say I, you know, I am going to the store, I'm talking about the body. I have a stomach ache, I may be talking about the prana, you know, or I'm feeling tired, I could be talking about the prana. Or I'm agitated or happy, I'm talking about my mind. See what I mean? So this atma, depending on whether it's being used relatively or it's being used within Vedanta to indicate the self, because you'll see when we're doing the Bhagavad Gita, sometimes Krishna, when he's talking about the Atmavan, that means the one who has the Atma, means the one who has control over his mind. Everybody has an Atma. You're not going to say you're an Atmavat as though somebody isn't. Atmavat means possesses. Well, you're an Atmavat. Well, you possess an Atma. Well, who doesn't possess an Atma? Right? I mean, everybody does. So Atma is being used differently there. It's being one who has control over their mind. The mind is in their hands. So in that way, the Atma, just translated as self, can be landing on any upadhi. But when we're talking about the Atma, Vedantically, in terms of your true nature, the nature of your, we call pratyag atma. Pratyag means that which is innermost. The self which is innermost means the one that can't be objectified, and you realize that actually this that I've always been taking to be myself is objectified. And it's really just an instrument, or it's a mind, thoughts in a mind, in the mind, etc., that I've identified with. But when you get to that innermost self, it's not objectifiable. And that's the Atma, that's who you are, actually. The others are all just superimpositions upon yourself. But when you get to the one that can't be objectified, that's you. And so then the Vedanta, the whole mission of the Vedanta, the whole, what we call Tatparya, what is the essence of the Vedanta? What is it that it's teaching? That's called Tatparya, the essential nature of it. And that is that yourself, this Atma, that you have, just from beginningless time, because of beginningless self-ignorance you've taken to be this body, mind, sense organs complex, your Atma actually is Brahman. Brahman means that which is infinite, that which is the very self of Ishvara. So the whole Vedanta is an unfoldment of what we call this Mahavakya. The Mahavakya is what the Vedanta has to teach, and that is some form of you are Brahman. It's either tat tvamasi, that's one Mahavakya, you are that, means this Atma really is Brahman, or this that you call the Jiva, right, is Ishvara. How could the Jiva be Ishvara? That's like saying, how could the wave be the ocean? Oh, wave, you are the ocean. How could that be? You have to go a different level to the water, and then there's only water there. And so these Mahavakyas have to be unfolded, like the Jiva is Brahman, Tattvamasi, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, Prajnanam Brahman, this consciousness, the consciousness, that is Brahman, that is infinite, non-dual. So this is the teaching, so what is the Atma? That is the question. That's the question. When a student comes to the teacher, that's what is the Atma is equal to, who am I? Who am I? Who am I really? This person that is here. Am I this body, which means I would die when the body dies, you know? Do I transmigrate, you know? What is my relationship with Ishvara? So it's not asking about who am I instead in terms of the conscious being that is here. I know me. But I don't know what this me is. I don't know if it's finite. I don't know if it is subject to birth and death. I don't know what it is in reference to Ishvara. I don't know what me is in reference to your me. You know, I don't know if it modifies or changes. So when you become a mumukshu, this becomes an important question. For most people, it is not an important question because on another level, this me is. Who it is answered all of the time. Right now, I am the teacher. That's who I am. You're the student. That's who you are. When you're with your mom, you know, you're the child. When you're the friend, you're a friend. When you're working, you're the employee. If you run your own business, you're the business. You know, you're the owner of the business. So, relationally, you are continually being identified all the time without any space in between. So it's as though you always know who you are. So when I said, you know, when I was talking to my mother after coming back to from India, she has no problem with who she is. She's the mother of six kids. You know, she's married to my father, and she's working, you know, taking care of his office and cooking for all the kids and doing all the washing. Mm-hmm. She knows very well who she is. She said, honey, I don't have that problem. I know who I am. You know? She didn't say that because that would be kind of conceited of her. You know, I don't have that problem. Of course I know who I am. I'm sorry that you don't. That's not how she is. She's really very sweet, very unassuming person, you know. But what she was really saying is, I don't want to talk about this anymore because it's kind of overwhelming. That's what she really meant. Yeah. So, anyway. Is that clear? We're done. So that means that we can sing a little bit. Anybody want to? You can start us, and then we'll. Who sings bhajans besides Sharada?
Malika,
you sing bhajans?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Satya? I've heard you sing before.
I don't know.
Who else does? Okay. Sanna?
Carlina.
Yeah, you do. Sanna, do you sing?
Mainly when people don't hear.
Yeah. Me too. Yeah, I wish it wasn't that way. I really do. I'd love to. Love that. Okay, Monica.
You know, there's a harmonium in there.
You want the harmonium? If somebody did that to me, I would run out the door. But you all know you sing bhajan, so I would love to sing them, but I just can't do it. Now, we're going to get a harmonium too for the farm. That would be nice. We'll get a harmonium for the farm also. Looks like a nice one.
Mm-hmm. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Radhikaye.
Om Namo Shatu Parajanyaha Priti Vesasya Shalini Desho Yamcho Barahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchit Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Satgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritangamaya Om Purnam. shanti 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 hari om shri gurubhyo namaha hari om